Accession number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollard, Reel 11. Now, what happened when you were scrambled? I mean, what, you know... when it was real, as opposed to when it was a practice. Obviously, you had to practice it a lot. But
well, I think... We always did full sorties, at any rate, whether the scramble turned out to be a practice or not.
And what was a sortie? You know, what would you do?
Sometimes it was at weekends, because what I didn't mention, obviously, was it was a 365 and a quarter year day commitment every year. And as soon as the first pair went off, they'd be, the 30-minute pair would come up to 5 minutes straight away, as soon as they could. And occasionally, you would go off. Well, hardly ever you'd go off as a four, because it would be unnecessary, but sometimes you'd be brought up in terms of exercises and things like that. And the other memory of Germany is some very early starts, because often you'd literally, 3 o'clock in the morning, I can remember literally one night having 40 minutes sleep, because the bell went, so to speak, and we were all woken up round about three for one of these exercises, and that became more and more routine over the time I was out there for exercises that were sprung on the station.
Now, what were these sorties like, either the exercises or the real thing? I don't know which you want to take first. I'll leave it to you.
Well, one had done sufficient practice interceptions that there was no great sweat on that, but it did concentrate your mind every time that you went off for real, so to speak. And you had to assume that it was an operational scramble. And I think occasionally they did reinforce that on the climb. And then you'd have to make quite certain that your guns were live. And also, what I didn't mention was that we all had high-velocity ammunition. And there was no problem with the six, but the four, the early parts of the four, connected with that surge problem, was you couldn't fire your guns at one stage above 25,000 with the high-velocity ammunition. But that quickly was over, and once we had the sixes, there were no problems about that.
So what was an operational interception mission like?
I think on the way up, as I say, it did make you think a little. Invariably, you'd be heading east for the border, and occasionally one was obviously being tested by the Warsaw Pact, and we knew there were hundreds of MiGs over there, vast numbers of them. We didn't have an air defense identification zone called the Eddies. The Eddies came later, and we just used to literally go up to the border itself and stay clear. And of course, it's a ragged border too. But when you were under operational control, close control by the Ground Controlled Interception, the GCI radar, that wasn't your pigeon, really. If you went over the border, that was their fault, but they'd make quite certain that that didn't happen. But then, because of one or two incidents, they ended up with this Aedes coming in, which was further west from the actual border.
Later.
Yeah. So, and on the climb...
how would you get your instructions through CGI radio, then?
Wow. With the GCI, you would normally, again, I don't think mission numbers had come in, or they were about to come in then, and I think we normally just used to be black section then. I think it was black lead and black two when you were scrambled normally, as opposed to the other colours, which would be, you know, yellow, green, red, and sometimes brown. Silver were used for your normal training, but within a year of that, I think mission numbers would be coming in.
So, when you, how did the CGI control you? GCI.
Yeah, the GCI.
What does it stand for?
Ground Control Interception, GCI. Yeah, and that would be from Broxetal, which wasn't that far from us, out towards the Dutch border.
Now, how did they actually control you? How did you receive your? Was it just through the
head? Yeah. if you were on telescramble at the end of the runway, which didn't happen that much actually, and it was more on exercises, I can remember that. But occasionally we were put out on the end of the runway, and there was one famous incident where someone got airborne with their believe it or not, with their ladder, because each hunter before you went off. You went up into the aircraft on a ladder, which was then taken away, and somebody at Yever actually scrambled with their ladder on, and he was actually the leader of the section in the confusion, and then the ladder came off and slightly damaged the aircraft, but and the number two had to go off, who was Roger Hymans, and he actually it was one of those returning U2s coming back in from the east, and he'd just been made operational. I was a very young bloke, and there he was with this U2 above him, and who he was overtaking, because as soon as he'd turned round onto the westerly heading below this U2, he could see that he was actually, it was far way above him, 12 or 13,000 feet above him, and he was nearly up at 50,000 feet. And then as soon as he got down again, of course, he was told that he hadn't seen it, because it was kept under wraps, that. But we would often know instinctively, because often we would get glints coming in at sometimes literally at 20, 25 out to 40 miles. You would sometimes get flashes of your target. And then if it was a returning Canberra that shouldn't be known about, that was coming in at high level out of the east zone, or a U2, almost invariably a senior controller would come on and make certain that you did turn, because we were a bit naughty often, because you'd like to get a bit closer to see what this thing was, because you'd gone to all the trouble of going up and being vectored onto this inbound aircraft, and almost everyone would be a bit slow to, you know, you'd be saying "say again" or something like that to controller, and they knew jolly well that you were playing games and just wanted to see what was actually coming in. And by that time, I think they'd been briefed. There was a mechanism that they were told at the last minute, you know, that it was one of ours coming back in from unauthorized, from highly authorized reconnaissance over there.
Now, so that you see them. Now, what about, how did the vectoring system work?
Well, that was completely up to the GCI, but normally it was what was called a parallel offset. And if you could use that later to one's own advantage if you were as a singleton, because in second TAF, There were rules of engagement between aircraft, but also there were something that I hadn't mentioned, which was standard operating procedures, which really meant that fighters operated so that you could actually operate between squadrons from the same airfield, knowing what people would do at various times on the way up. And
what were these standard operating procedures?
Well, there were a whole list of things.
Operational or operating?
Standard operating, yeah, which was more to do with the way that you actually flew the aircraft. And the more that you'd made standard, obviously reduced the amount of briefing time. There were ways of going up. I haven't mentioned other aspects that were done far more there in those days. Where you did snake climbs and things like that
through the
cloud on the way up, but that again would overlap in these standard operating procedures, because you would know, and different squadrons developed them, and more it was done on a wing basis, and that was coming in so that the standard operating procedures, how you operated your aircraft, and that's every bit of the operation, including the operational side, became more and more standard and more developed over those next 5 or 10 years in the Royal Air Force. About that time, too, we became much more careful about dropping booms when we were dogfighting. And that.
No, hang on. We're definitely not talking about dogfight. We're talking about interception missions here.
Well, it's probably because, to some extent, they were some of our most boring sorties of the lot. Apart from the adrenaline rush that you got and making certain that on the way up all your gun sight was right and you'd be able to get your guns live, etc. And that aspect of, was it for real? What I haven't mentioned was quite a lot of aircraft would come down the airway just to the north of us, and some of those would be Russian, the Tupolev aircraft. And some of those, one imagines, were up to other things as well. But then the GCI people, as soon as you were released from that, often we would do one or two more practice interceptions with them before we split away for their training.
So from what you're saying, you never actually encountered a Soviet or Russian aircraft incurring interceptions?
No, because sometimes
one way or another practice,
yeah,
or they were close
returning
by.
Returning, yeah, because sometimes they would come up to the border, you see, and then change. And that was what I was trying to mention about the weekends, you see, the Saturdays and Sundays, because we always thought that was marvellous. And sometimes we would ring up to make certain that the GCI scrambled us, because, you know, having come in very early or something like that, you'd want to fly. And occasionally we'd get through to the controllers and say, look, try and get us off at weekends. But to my knowledge, myself, and I think for most other people, that was the norm. That apart from these strays that we were always kept away from, it's probably wrong to call them strays because that's the last thing they were coming inbound.
So in a sense, it was us that was being naughty. We were sending unauthorized spy planes over the Soviet area, but they were not sending anything over our area.
No, that was right. There were the odd unidentified things, because occasionally a civil aircraft would get something wrong, and you knew jolly well that if you were going up to 40, 45,000 feet, that it was for real. That often at 20,000 feet there would be the odd aircraft that it would either an administrative cock-up or something like that, because sometimes, and they were very easy to obviously to intercept and identify quickly.
And they're just accidental civilian incursions.
That's right, because you had these three, what I haven't mentioned, but people would know, was these three channels out from Berlin of the corridors. There were three air corridors and three effectively road corridors underneath, one to Hamburg and one down to the southwest and one down to the more to the American zone coming out of Berlin. And of course there were but what we did not do, but what at certain times later was done, was this going up the corridor. I never once went up the corridor to Berlin. That had happened earlier times, more way back in the Tempest time, because of course it would be very provocative for fighter aircraft to go up that way unless it was a show of force. Now each wing also, and having been on both wings, I was very fortunate, because going down later it was very easy to know the whole procedure. As I say, this parallel offset that people did to take you around in behind the aircraft. This was the thing that you'd be curved round. They would calculate that you'd be turning round on the tail of what you were intercepting in such a position, ideally, to put you about a mile behind, so that you could and open fire at 800 yards, or ideally much closer. But
and this is called what? The parallel?
Parallel offset interception. And occasionally, and I think it, the first time I did it, and I only did it once at Yeva, I'm pretty certain it was Yeva I did, was to actually ask during the practice interceptions to very cheekily, I set them up so that I did three perfectly for them, because you could really make things very easy for the people, the controller, and I did it with my eyes open because I wanted to try a head-on interception. And I've never forgotten that, because I never put it in the logbook, never spoke to anyone about it, but it was an American RB-47 coming the other way. And I'd remembered that in the Meteor days, they used to occasionally do head-on interceptions, but to do it at something that was, it was only travelling at 0.8 this, but if to see an aircraft, and it's a dirty great aircraft then, tiny little spot in your windscreen, and this chap allowed me, this controller, to do this head-on interception, and really it was extremely dangerous, because and even more dangerous to do the way that you were supposed to do it, to keep it in sight all the time. And I've never forgotten that, trying to do this and at a closing speed of 1.7 Mach or more. And I never told anybody afterwards about it, and I'm not quite certain that other people were daft enough to try it. But it was a great learning curve, because I realised how difficult that would be, you know, these head-on attacks, which people talked about. And, of course, you'd really be spraying. And what Silt taught you was that really how difficult it was to actually put your bullets in an area where they would work for you. Now, a whole variety of aircraft were out there, though, that I haven't mentioned, that there'd be a lot of Canadian CF-100s, the Canucks, there'd be a lot of Belgian Hunters, there'd be a lot of RF-84s, RF-84Fs, that's the Thunderstreaks, there'd be the 84s, the straight-wing ones, there'd be Uragans occasionally, the French aircraft. The BF-100s were already out there, the Super Sabre, and tremendous variety. Probably, as I say, probably 20 different types there. There'd be C-119 packets occasionally, and then there'd be civil aircraft that would go all muddled up where they shouldn't have been. And that tended to happen also more at kind of Christmas or a holiday, something like that. And not invariably, but there'd probably be you'd probably only have a 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 chance, if you were on operational standby, of it's being the real thing that was then not the real thing, if you understand what I mean, that for some reason they were just testing the defences, because often it was just a stray aircraft coming in. But between us, we've probably spoken too much about this, because very much it was only a fraction of your role.
So what were you doing?
It was shared out between the other wing. So that was 1-2-2 wing and 1-2-4 wing. 1-2-2 wing was the Yeva wing, and 1-2-4 was the Oldenburg wing, which then went to Ahlhorn.
That was 1-2-4
wing. And they'd be sharing.
In it.
No, that was 1-2-2 up at Yeva, but 1-2-4 that I'd been in with 26. And would go back to. And the rest of the time, as I believe I mentioned, we were just about within, I'd have thought, weeks, certainly within 2 months, the 100-gallon drop tanks had come in. And then, surprisingly, the more powerful engine was slightly offset, of course, by the fact that we'd now got the 200-gallon tanks on. So the performance at altitude wasn't as great a difference, if you understand what I mean. We've got the much more powerful engine, but we were always flying around with the 200-gallon tanks on, as standard, as all the Hunters were in Germany, which gave you longer sorties. So you tended to get more flying per sortie, and perhaps the average was maybe 40, 45 minutes from memory, and that would go up to 1 hour or 1 hour five, something like that.
So what were you doing? You see what I mean?
We were doing everything that fighter squadrons did, and that was you'd go off, even if you were just going off as a singleton, you would always be looking for trouble with other aircraft, and almost there were no rules. You weren't allowed to attack aircraft in the airways, of course. Just to the north of Germany, there was an airway going down. But apart from that, almost anything that was in the air, you could have a go at. In terms of mock attacks and what have you. So even if you were off as a singleton, it was quite likely that, A, you would be intercepted, and it'd have to keep your eyes open behind you. Because what I didn't mention with the Hunter was, compared certainly with the Sabre and some other aircraft, your rear vision was not good. But to compensate for that, people right from the word go would always be wanging on bank one way and wanging on bank the other way to look at your 6 o'clock, because they'd be so aware of that. And it was interesting, when you saw aircraft, you could see them all doing this, even at altitude, because obviously the more you do that, it would slow you down a wee bit at altitude. But invariably, if there were two of you, you'd be in a fighting section out, watching each other's tail, and even more so with just as much when there were four of you. And you'd have one section that would be down sun, but looking into the sun, and that would be your high element. You're 3 and 4, and as I believe I mentioned before, you tend to be up at 40, 45,000 feet, either fast at 43, 44, 45, depending on your fuel weight, at 0.9, or a bit higher and a bit slower, and sometimes variations on that. And really, you were always looking for trouble, and that was what it was.
And if you did a mock attack on an aircraft, would you then do one of these dogfights? Would you practice?
Well, if they were other hunters, you'd invariably do that, and often with other aircraft, in similar fashion. But Canberras would virtually never turn towards you. Only occasionally, Vulcans were quite difficult to catch. I mean, often you'd spend 60, 100 miles sometimes trying to catch a Vulcan, and it was quite difficult to do at altitude. But they were really beautiful things to see, both the Vulcan and the Victor. And they were the early ones then, the Vulcan ones. But to see them early in the morning or last thing at night in the sunset, they were really, it was something really ethereal, at high level at altitude.
Now, you said it's while this sort of mock dogfights things, you had to be careful about booms, sonic booms at this point.
Yeah, but that was only a minor thing, really, because all I'm saying was that there was a change in the context that you thought the North German plane to start with was such a massive, great area, and it wasn't really a problem. But it was a question of courtesy with the Germans, because that was also altering. Because one thing that even when I went out, and that was early 1957, the Germans still did have it in their heads that the military could almost do anything, in terms of the civilian side. And even applied that to us as the Royal Air Force, and didn't fuss about those sort of things. But gradually, for various reasons, that was tweaked back, and we were careful not to go supersonic over the, when we were dogfighting together. But sections, you see, would go up as four, and then they'd split for fighting as two pairs. And they would actually, what I didn't mention in the practice interceptions, was you'd also split as pairs or a four and a pair, and practice two versus four, four versus two, four versus a singleton, and so on. And I've made it sound as though there wasn't an awful lot to get to know, because, people didn't waste time in the air.
So lots of practice dogfighting.
Yes, and that became more so. We weren't doing that much low level, and then up at up at Yeova, I remember that really we were just beginning to start doing more air-to-ground then. It was just coming in. So in other words, our role was gradually altering to include low-level and air-to-ground, in other words, in support more of the army. Up until then, and again, I felt I was very fortunate because I'd seen the pure interceptor side where the Hunter was used virtually completely at altitude. And then there was a gradual conversion to more and more being done at low level. And that was partly to do with missiles, and it was partly to do with the threat, and it was partly to do with the fact that obviously they were getting more and more worried about the threat from Russian tanks coming in, and increasingly the army cooperation side was coming back in terms of support of forward forces and that.
So how did you practice your low level flying, the ground strafing role?
Yeah, that, as I say, was just literally starting when I was up at Yeova, and then it would gradually come in and take more and more of one's time, that you'd spend more and more time down at low level, because obviously the people that started 2 years later or 3 years later than myself never saw the heyday of the Hunter at high level. And occasionally, more later when we got put the 100-gallon tanks on the outboards, which we never liked using, but occasionally squadrons would use that to clock up their time to keep the powers that be at headquarters happy about the amount of flying they'd done. But really, it was very negative time for the people. It was no instruction to the pilots that were going off on these navigational exercises round UK. We rather despised that whole thing of people just trying to get flying time, a lot of flying time, just to keep group and command happy about the amount of hours that the squadrons were doing, because you could have 35-minute dogfight time from airborne to touchdown without tanks, and about 55 minutes or less, and you'd learn more in that time than 100 of these other sorties where they were putting the outboard tanks on, because the Hunter wasn't very good with the outboard tanks on at all.
Tanks as well. I mean,
yeah, we had the standard, as I said, once we were on the sixes, we had the 200-gallon tanks, and that to some extent, we'd have obviously loved to have punched those off, because then we'd have got right up to 50,000 and above.
So they were 200-gallon?
Two times. 100-gallon under each mid-wing point, roughly, looking at it.
And then the outboard one, where were they?
They were even further outboard.
Further out the wing.
Yeah.
And they were 100
gallons too, yes. And then the later development with the Hunter for abroad was to have two 30-gallon tanks in the inboard stations. And that was, once the baffles had been put in, that was a very good solution. But that was more the Mark 9 or the 6A in that.
Could you jettison these tanks or not?
Yes, yeah, because that was the whole, they were drop tanks. And
where would you drop them, though? I mean, over the North German plain?
Well, if you were, we'd spoken about the battle flight, going off on battle flight. I mean, if it really had been a severe threat, and you'd have had no compunction at the right time in dropping your drop tanks to make the aircraft much more agile at height, because obviously, as I say, you'd have got easily another 4,000 feet.
Without, would you drop them in the normal state of affairs?
No, not never.
So you'd bring them back?
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously, you know,
there was
an awful, yeah, they were big and heavy.
So it was a facility that you could drop.
That's
them,
right.
You
the whole idea, no, you never did. I only once did that much later, and that was on the Torrey Canyon to actually fire off the outboards, and that was with napalm.